Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 3rd, 2006, and today's session is entitled Colonialism Revisited, presented by Lowell Satry, number SAL 2006-04. Let's listen in.
I'm Lowell Satry. I've seen quite a few of you at my sessions before. I don't know that all of you have been to one of mine. I'm a retired professor of history from Youngstown State University, and I've been giving a series of sessions this week on human rights and slavery, basically, and spin-offs of that. Tonight we're going to take a look at the question, is globalization a 21st century version of 19th century colonialism? That's what we're going to be looking at. I don't know that, well, certainly, I think it's fair to say that no word has been used more to describe the economy and worldwide society and social developments in the last two decades than the term globalization. It is constantly used. It's always used. And what I want to do tonight, there are a few things. First of all, we want to take a look at what is globalization. I have a definition of it from the World Trade Organization. And then we're going to take a look, almost read a list and expand on that list a bit, about the implications, about the manifestations of globalization. What has it meant to life? Now, when I'm done doing that, we're going to stop a little bit and we'll deal with some questions. And then I'm going to go on to other items. One of the things I want to particularly point out to you to have you understand is that globalization is not unique to the last 20, 30 years. Some people say that we are in fact in the second age of globalization. And I want to talk then for a while about those two great ages of globalization and point out how and why it was interrupted, because it was greatly interrupted. And then we'll stop and look at some questions then. Keep in mind questions, jot them down, make mental lists. And in the last part, I'm going to be talking about the age of imperialism or the age of colonialism in the late 19th and early part of the 20th century. When in many ways that first age of globalization was at its peak. And I tell you, I'll try to point out some of them. It is eerie, the similarities between the two periods of today, as well as this colonialism of the late 19th and early 20th century. And as today, globalization then and now has very much its positive aspects and its negative aspects. We all benefit from globalization. We all, one way or another, probably are hurt by certain aspects of globalization. Now, certainly, a lot of people in the world are the same way we are. They benefit, and huge numbers do not. So, that's what I'm going to try to do tonight. I have a definition that is taken from the International, I said World Trade Organization, the International Monetary Fund. It defines globalization as the growing economic interdependence of countries worldwide through increasing volume of trade. And that trade can be services, it can be products. It doesn't have to be products. I mean, that's one thing that you have to keep in mind is that when you think of globalization, when you think of the economy, and it's true in the 19th century as today, we're not dealing with just manufactured goods. We're also dealing with communication, both then and now, for example. And this increase in trade in goods is made possible partly by an increasing international flow of capital. And capital is what makes international trade work. And if you follow the markets at all today, I mean, what's exploded in the last 20 years is international capital. I mean, and you can, you can see it everywhere. You can see the number of banks that have emerged. I mean, banks that you've never heard of suddenly will set up shop in your town. And another thing that's helped make this possible is a more rapid and widespread diffusion of technology. So what is closely connected, certainly today, with globalization is capital and technology. Those are two of the great facilitators of this globalization, this huge increase in trade. Now let me go through, and this is a little more than a list, of the manifestations or the implications, and I've touched on some of these already. Greater worldwide trade. And that's obvious to everybody. Freer flow of capital. And not only has it facilitated been so much freer, but over the last 8 to 10 years, the interest rates have been incredibly low. And that has speeded up this flow of capital. Lower labor costs. And that you're certainly well aware of. I mean, in the production, it's lower labor cost, partly because it has become worldwide. And there are so many areas in the world where they're able to tap very, very low cost labor. And you're all well aware of the shrinking manufacturing or industrial base in the United States. And it essentially is fleeing to or going to other areas where the labor cost is so much less. I'm from Youngstown, Ohio, and there's probably no state has had the loss of industrial jobs as the state of Ohio. It's been a disaster what's happened in the last decade or two. greater variety of goods. You're buying goods, you get goods now that you never got 15, 20 years ago. Lower cost for many products. Another thing is, manufacturing centers in the world versus centers where they produce basic commodities, the ores, the zinc, the copper, which this place doesn't produce anymore. But that's common. I mean, we have certain areas of the world today that produce goods, and they're not nearly as concentrated, for instance, in the United States or Europe as they have been for a long time. Now they are in the Philippines, or especially in China, and a number of other areas. Extremes of wealth and poverty. It's in the news in many ways all the time. And it is one of the things that feeds unrest in certain areas of the world. Cultural exchange and homogenization. I mean, we frankly know, first of all, we know far more about other cultures, or we can know far more about other cultures than we ever have before. And those other cultures come to the United States. The United States culture goes elsewhere. I mean, the great example, of course, is McDonald's. It's the great example of homogenization. It's true in cultural exchange. The United States is no longer the greatest producer of movies in the world. That's India. India is the great producer of motion pictures. It's called Bollywood. That's the term that's used, Bollywood. I mean, they produce them in just huge numbers. And oh, they have these, you know, these sweet love stories and all these different things come out. Pardon?
I've seen a few really good ones.
Oh, yeah, they're fine. But I mean, they have. It's no different in the United States.
Right.
I mean, most of it's trash, some of it's very, very good.
Well, it would be just like dime novels. Yeah.
Now, I just wanted to throw out those. How do you feel about globalization? I pointed out some of the good points, some of the bad points, but how do you individually feel about globalization? Or how has it impacted your life?
How do I feel about it? It kind of reflects the list. There's some good things and there's some bad things, and I feel conflicted about it.
I feel like one, and I didn't get in on the beginning.
That's all right, yeah.
It seems as though, to a certain extent, we've managed to export a slave economy. It's happening, but it's happening somewhere else. And I feel like a lot of our economy is based on other people sort of doing things that at very low cost to us, under bad conditions, all those sorts of things that you might see as a slave economy. We've exported that, and we're sort of reaping the benefits here. Yeah.
And that's, it's a major problem. I mean, but yet, you know, you come up with a time, there are some people that say, buy American. You've all heard that, buy American?
Well, I find that
I'll tell you,
hard to do.
Yeah. Well, not only is it hard to do, but you wouldn't want it to take place.
Would not want it.
You would not want buy American to succeed.
Why?
Because the economy of the world would implode. It would fall apart. If we bought only America, well, the last time that happened led to the Great Depression. I mean, to buy American is, we're tied into a worldwide economy.
Are you saying that we certainly don't deserve another depression, or what?
I say we don't deserve another depression. I mean the danger of buy America.
Yeah.
Is that it will slow down worldwide trade.
So who's right and who's wrong?
Well, I mean, my point is that if nobody wants to live through the Great Depression again. Very few.
Also, it wouldn't only hurt the United States.
Oh, absolutely not.
It would be so bad.
As the Great Depression was worldwide, the only part of the world that wasn't impacted by the Great Depression were areas that had no trade to start with the world. Soviet Union, because they had isolated themselves by the 1930s and were taking care. You go into certain parts of India, certain parts of China, where they had a subsistence form of living only.
Right. They just took care of their own needs, tribal life.
Right. And we can't take care of our own needs. We haven't been able to take care of our own needs for a long, long, long time.
We probably could.
No, we couldn't. No.
No,
we would never have a chance. Most of the goods, I would say, much of the goods we use in industrial manufacturing, even in this country, we're dependent on the raw materials from abroad. A lot of it doesn't exist in this country.
A lot of trace raw materials.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, what about the problem with that so much of our economy is based upon consumer consumption, much of which is, if we look at the world, and what we've been doing in Barbara Rossing's sessions, is that, you know, if we continue at this pace, well, and that was last week too with John McGrath, I mean, we need six worlds if everybody was consuming on the level that Americans are.
Could do.
Exactly. So I mean, this is going to cause, just if we begin to shrink as we need to our consumption, this will cause a slowdown in the economy of the world.
Yep. And I'm not, in fact, I very much agree with you. I think we have a consumer economy that's gone just bonkers, right now. We just consume things. It's incredible. But, you know, this is a part of globalization. We try our darndest to get other people in the world to buy like we do. I'm not saying that's right, but that's what's going on. In fact, it's bizarre what's going on as far as consumption.
So we want other people to have three cars in the garage? Is that what you're saying? Or we want
let's reverse that.
Or are you saying, do we want other people in the world to buy American products?
Well, of course we want to buy American products. But the globalization is, that's a part of it. That's the basic part of it. Let's reverse it.
Well, when do you think it began? Maybe we have to go into the...
Well, I'll get to that eventually. I'll get to globalization, the beginnings of globalization eventually. Yeah.
I'd say that the question about buying American and about the effects of consuming less, in the economic slowdown out of jail, I think that gets to the heart of what capitalism is. is dependent on this kind of frivolous consumption that we see, and that it's dependent on, you need the workforce that you can exploit, whether that's at home, and if that gets too, if, you know, the wages are too at home, then you have to exploit someone abroad. So I think it just, it shows capitalism for what it is, in my opinion.
Capitalism is the most efficient production of goods that's ever been. Far and away, it is not necessarily the best distributor of goods.
And the goods it distributes aren't necessarily good goods. I mean, you know, the thriving military-industrial complex, you know.
Capitalism, I look at, is not moral or immoral. It's amoral. There's nothing moral or immoral about it. It is simply a system to produce good. Go ahead.
Okay, well, we just heard in the last session about China, and what you're saying, it probably won't be a problem because China will be using all of the products, and if we use less, that won't matter really because they have such a large consumer.
Yeah, but what are you wondering? You say if China...
Well, you were saying buy America, you know, and what's going to happen if we don't buy America. To me, that doesn't sound like it's a problem because China, it will take over
China,
products are less, cost less. And,
somebody else had to handle it. Yeah.
Well, I just hear a lot of the word globalization, meaning a kind of bullying action to force free market capitalism on the rest of the world, and therefore, because of the power we have, robbing them of their own economic self-rule, and that seems to be very negative.
And
they may not choose that for their economic system, but they literally have no choice today because of the bullying power of the large capitalist countries.
Yes.
Which, to a large degree, means companies.
But of course, the companies aren't even national.
That's what I'm saying.
Anymore.
That's what I'm saying.
They are international.
Yeah. Well, like people say, you know, you should learn history so you don't repeat it. And one thing that I think is going on with globalization is there was colonialism, and that didn't work out, you know, independence of South America. And then there was imperialism, and that didn't work out, independence of India. And now there's globalization. And I feel like it's just the exact same thing as colonialism and imperialism with a new name and a new face. And it's just going to, same fate's going to happen to it.
It's very similar.
And it's easier to get by with because there's less overt blood.
Pardon?
Rather than colonialism or imperialism, I wouldn't say it's bloodless, but it's not there. Like, it's not...
I mean, colonialism involved, frankly, and imperialism involved a great degree of warfare.
Yeah, so you can get away with globalization.
And globalization does not necessarily not involve that.
Yeah, so you talk about agricultural production. Our balance of payment in this country would be way out of whack if it wasn't that our agricultural exports have been increasing every year. For instance, we were talking about China for sure, the foreigners, just reading in the article. For instance, they can produce a pound of soybean meal. The conversion rate to fish is almost a pound for a pound. We can't do that with cattle or hogs or poultry or anything else. So we can see what happens. And they're taking record amounts of our balance of payment would be way off the map if it wasn't for agriculture exports going up.
Then why is our agriculture so relatively inexpensive?
Because we're so efficient.
We subsidize.
There's something else. It is one of the most heavily subsidized parts of the American economy.
Well, I can argue that.
Well, it's heavily subsidized. Trust me. Cargill and a number of these companies get massive amounts of subsidy. Agribusiness is awash in money.
They're in international too, though. Cargill.
Oh, I know they are.
Cargill is Minneapolis, and have you ever been in Minneapolis? You ever been in Cargill's complex in Minneapolis?
No, I haven't.
Anybody that's ever been in Minneapolis should visit that if you can, because that is something out of this world.
Yeah.
Cargill's corporate complex.
So what are you saying we should visit? What is it we should
see? Well, it's about 4 square blocks, and it's all private. It's a Cargill is an independent company. It isn't a stock company. It's a family-owned company.
Okay.
Privately.
It's a close corporation. In other words, it's international, and they're into more things than you ever can think about. Salt and minerals and crops and anything you can think of.
Yeah.
In a big way.
Huge. It's one of the world's largest. It is.
They walk into one room, they tell me that I had a friend of mine that was in there one time, and he said, well, first of all, it was security that he wouldn't hardly believe to walk into the place. And he said they had the whole board up there, just like Chicago Board of Trade, and there are people sitting there. And they're trading in commodities all over the world all the time. That's going on 24 hours a day. It's unbelievable.
And of course, the argument that nations in Africa particularly make is that because agricultural goods are so heavily subsidized, those farmers in certain African countries are countries whose governments are unable to subsidize them, can't compete with the United States or even more Europe. The European Union, or the European Union has the most heavily subsidized agricultural products in the world, far and away. It was within this past week that negotiations to expand essentially free trade agreements broke down. And it broke down over the inability of the United States and the European Union to agree on a reduction of subsidy for farmers, for agriculture. That was the cause of the breakdown.
Can I bring another point?
Sure, please. Yeah.
I farmed for all my life.
Yeah.
I can remember starting in farming in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. Corn was $2 a bushel. And it's still less than $2 a bushel. Where's the subsidy?
Well,
you're not getting it,
but trust me, it is heavily subsidized.
There are corporations now that are collecting off.
Oh yeah.
Doctors and lawyers in towns that are getting subsidies,
yep.
And they're not really a producing member.
You don't get a check from the feds?
Not anymore. I'm retired now.
When you had the farm actively, you didn't get a check from the feds.
Well, there are two separate programs.
I know there are. Are you saying you didn't get?
I don't deny that I didn't get a check.
What would you call
it? I mean, I grew up on a farm. My parents were involved in
what
do you call it? Soil bank?
I know all about that.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what the distribution payment? Yeah. We couldn't. There's a lot of farmers that could not survive without a deficiency payment right now.
I know that.
In the Midwest, and especially with our high fuel prices.
I couldn't agree with you more, but I should call it a subsidy.
Well, it could be called a subsidy, but we aren't.
And by the way, I think it's a good thing to do.
Anything else?
Well, thank you.
You want to bring up? I'll have to cut it off sometime. I don't really want to, but I'll have to because they'll never get out of it. But my point in all of this is that it's very controversial, globalization. And who benefits and who doesn't is very, very evident. I mean, it is. What I wanted to talk a bit about next is just to rather quickly review the various eras of globalization and to a certain extent how it came about. The first era of globalization is roughly 1850 to 1914. It was to a certain extent a spin-off of ideas proposed by what are called the classical economists. Economics became a study in the course of the 18th and early part of the 19th century. And the most influential of them, and to a certain extent still the most influential of all of these to the present day, is Adam Smith. Adam Smith, ironically in 1776, you should be able to remember that date. In 1776, he published on the wealth of nations, and that's plural. The wealth on the wealth of nations. Published in 1776. And what he argued was that the old economic political system in Europe, and it was called mercantilism. Called mercantilism. Was a barrier to the production of goods, and it was a barrier to improved material goods in the lives of the people. And he said the reason for this is that there was so much state regulation. Nations in Europe regularly gave monopolies to certain companies. The Virginia colony. Was founded, the Virginia colony in the early 1600s, was essentially founded by the Virginia Company, which was a monopoly granted by the English government for one company to exclusively develop the area of Virginia. Massachusetts Bay Company was the same thing. The development of certain parts of Canada occurred under the auspices of the Hudson's Bay Company. Again, a company was granted essentially monopoly control over certain parts of Canada. That's just one part of it. I mean, it goes on and on. I mean, the various parts of goods were heavily subsidized. And also, there were trade barriers. I mean, you simply couldn't produce some things. And that was one of the big arguments between the American colonies and its mother country, England, in the course of the 18th century, was that there were certain goods that were reserved for production only in England. Even if the American colonies could make it more efficiently, they weren't permitted to do it. And this was designed essentially to try to increase the economic power of the nation. And that economic power of England or France, or those are the two big countries at that time, if they could manage to amass more wealth, that wealth could be turned into higher taxes. Taxes could be directed towards greater military and on. It could be oriented towards more efficient collection of taxes, which in turn increased the power of the nation. And Adam Smith said, it doesn't work that way. I mean, in fact, what you need to do, he said, is to increase trade. And you increase trade by getting rid of all of those barriers, all of those special privileges permitted to what he referred to as relatively few people. Let those who are most efficient at making a good, let them make it. So one country is going to be good at making wine, another one textiles, another one food. Let each of those produce and let them trade. And that's why it's the term the wealth of nations. To make it possible for them to produce what they were best at producing and to exchange them. He published this in 1776. The first, let's say, free trade nation, the first nation that got rid of virtually all of its tariffs, and one of the few nations to ever do it, was England in the late 1840s. So it took Adam Smith's ideas 75 years to come to fruition. 75 years. So one of the ways you can say is that I think that's why scholars say 1850 marked roughly the beginning of the age of globalization. By that time, there had emerged at least one country that essentially had free trade. It had free trade. And let me go on to talk a little bit about how this happened. At the basis of this new age of globalization was industrialization. Industrialization began in England in roughly the 1760s, 1770s. It was the first industrial nation, and that is, there are a lot of connotations of it, but one of the things is that England was able to produce essentially a huge number of goods, normally with the use of machines at a relatively low cost. And that industrialization gradually spread to other nations. So that in the course of the 19th century, almost all, not all, but much of Europe ended up becoming industrialized. The United States started industrializing seriously in the early 19th century, the early 1800s. So that's the basis of much of the wealth. That exploding wealth in this age of globalization was to a great extent made possible by mechanization. And again, it's quite similar to what's going on today. Another thing that came out of it was specialization of trade. And I won't go into that. I already mentioned. I'll mention two or three countries. England was the greatest producer of textiles in the world. Normally, I think when people think of England's Industrial Revolution, they think of coal and steel and iron and things like that. In fact, the basis for its wealth, the basis for its power in England and worldwide was cotton textile goods. That is what they were great at producing. Germany, of course, Germany didn't come into existence until 1871. It's one of the newer nations in Europe. Germany ended up being, for example, a great producer of chemical goods. France ended up being wonderful producers of food, and particularly wine. That leads us to another thing, and that is a gradual decrease in tariffs throughout much of Europe. I want to say about 1869 or so, a trade treaty was signed between Britain and France. And I remember the thing that France got to do was essentially flood England with wine. Another aspect, and this to a certain extent ties into what we talked about, globalization, the facilitation of the movement of capital, is that roughly after 1850, countries started increasingly adopting the gold standard, so that indeed their currencies became pegged to the value of gold. And that was important in trade, to know that, when you're going to buy something from another country, it's, you knew what its currency was going to be. And another thing I should also point out here as a part of this is, Europe, from 1870 and on, there's a wonderful book written by a guy by the name of Herbert Feiss, wrote it in about 1930. He's called Europe, the World's Banker. From 1870 to 1914, Europe flooded the world with capital. Incredible amounts of capital. The United States economy would not have developed as fast as it did in the 19th and early part of the 20th century without the huge influx of European capital. We were a debtor nation until the end of World War I. That's the first time we were not indebted. Now we're in debt again, enormously. But from the beginning of the American nation until, I think it was 1917 or 18, we were in debt to others. And in many ways, what really facilitated this age of globalization was what is referred to as the Pax Britannica, the Peace of Britain. And that simply refers to the relative peace imposed by Britain through the development of its empire. Britain's empire, I can get into this later, but I'll do it now. From 1815 to 1914, Britain's empire expanded annually the size of Ohio, Pennsylvania, Maryland, and a little bit more. For 100 years.
Every single year.
Adding Ohio, Pennsylvania, Maryland, and a little bit more. And by 1920, just after the Great War, it reached its peak because it got, those of you who have been been here attending the Middle Eastern things that Jonathan has been talking about. Britain gained control over areas of the Middle East at that time. And that was the British Empire's peak. One-fourth of the land surface in the world is controlled by Great Britain. And Britain's control that way, and to a great extent, really, really facilitated it. Okay, let's stop a little bit. Candace, anybody else have questions on this?
I just wondered,
yeah.
Proportionally, like the U.S. was free, so like France had an empire, how much of the world was not under, okay, one-fourth was British Empire.
I don't know how much. I'll try to get to this later. I don't actually have an answer, but I will talk about this in far more detail while I'm going into this right now. I don't know what percentage would be.
But your point is probably going to be that one-fourth was under Britain.
Under Britain.
And today we have one, and it's the U.S. as far as globalization.
Well, it's a little different.
Okay.
I mean, it is a little different. Okay. But any other questions on what I've done here? Just this. Just in general terms that I'm trying to point out, the age of globalization. Yeah, the first one.
What you said about how did you say
capital,
that?
The export of capital?
And that's what's happening now with the United States being asked to put capital into some of the countries. For example, Russia now is looking for, in certain industries are looking for people who will come over and put a little bit of money.
We're totally dependent by this time in the United States today on capital flowing into our country.
But what I'm saying is we are putting capital into
nothing compared to what flows into this country. It's not even close.
Raw capital comes in and then the money comes.
We are spending the reason I say that is because we have such huge deficits. Federal deficits. We are constantly asking people to purchase bonds, is what it amounts to. And what happens is that especially the Russians and the Chinese are the biggest holder of dollars in the world.
You mean they're buying bonds?
Well, they're buying money. They're actually buying the dollar more than anything. But that still is a way to indeed for capital to pour into the United States. We are going to be in really big trouble if China and Russia do not continue to buy our dollars, because I mean the federal deficit is just huge, biggest it's ever been. Yeah.
So a piece of this was that Britain, as an example, could manufacture, but Britain grew no cotton.
That's right.
They had to get it from other sources, and then part of the empire builds as they're trying to protect those sources and make sure, like, Egypt was a cotton source, but it was also in the Suez Canal so they could get to to India. So a lot of this is, I mean, they're also protecting these resources.
Oh, absolutely.
Sites,
that's why they had the Navy. Greatest navy in the world is the protection of trade. That was it.
This is what value on the this will do a damage to the value of the dollar in the long run, isn't it?
Well, it sure could. I'm not an economist. I am a historian. I better mention that. But yes, I mean,
sometime or another, our dollar is going to be way down there.
Well, so far it's holding up.
Yeah, they're pretty good now compared to 5 years ago.
Yeah, it's relatively strong. I mean, a lot of economists are shaking their head because they
are wondering why
it is a stable. Yeah. Now, let me go on and point out that this first age of globalization first collapsed in World War I because it was truly a worldwide war. And trade, to a great extent, ceased. But in many ways, But the biggest thing that killed this huge international trade was the Great Depression. I mean, the Great Depression from 1929 to 1939 curtailed international trade. Nations turned increasingly on themselves to protect their own trade. I think it was the highest tariff in U.S. history occurred in 1931. And of course, it killed international trade. And you should see, the United States had exported a lot of capital in the period from 1918 and on. And
We had exported a lot of capital, for instance, to Latin America. By the Great Depression, we exported zero capital. Zero capital to Latin America. There was no capital. And I mean, this great age of international trade absolutely dried up. And it took a long time to, you know, study to get this pump, prime it, and get it going again. Technically, what happened was World War II helped to get it going again. FDR made us feel good about things getting better, but scholars have pointed out that indeed things hadn't really gotten all that much better. You just felt better about your misery. Certain extent of what's happened. I'm maybe being a little unfair to FDR. But now, the last age of globalization, the age we're in now is from 1945 to the present. And I will simply almost go over a list of some of the items involved in aiding this re-globalization. Any number of things occurred, but you're certainly well aware of it. In many ways, the most successful foreign aid, this I'd say without doubt, the most successful foreign aid this country has ever been involved in is what's called the Marshall Plan. When the United States helped the Europe, which had been destroyed during the war, helped it rebuild economically. We poured, I think, at that time, $1 billion is a big thing. It isn't today anymore. $1 billion was a lot of money at one time. And we put in $13 billion in the rebuilding of Europe from roughly 1947 to 1951 or 52. And it got trade going. It was an encouragement of trade. The biggest thing that has encouraged international trade has been a series of multilateral or bilateral trade agreements that have especially reduced tariffs. The world recognized, that indeed the Great Depression couldn't be repeated. I mean, you had to open up areas of trade. And you probably heard of GATT, G-A-T-T, General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, I think that's what it means. GATT, and that came out in, it was the 1950s or so. World Trade Organization is another thing that has particularly worked for better trade arrangements. In many ways, the most successful of these has been what was originally called the European Common Market. It's now more often referred to as the European Union, that got rid of all trade barriers within Europe. I mean, within much of Europe, there are no trade barriers. I mean, it's not only there are no trade barriers, there's no barriers to the movement of goods from one area to another. There's no barrier to the movement of people, of labor from one area to another. No barrier on capital, nothing. I mean, if you are a physician in Portugal and you were educated in Portugal, you can go to England and become a physician. I mean, it touches virtually all aspects of life are opened up. And then in many ways has been one of the most successful. What has been very controversial, but what was signed to facilitate trade was NAFTA, or the North American Free Trade Association. And of course, people feared that a lot of the manufacturing goods would end up in Mexico. Now, you know, Mexico has not benefited all that much from it, because Mexico now is losing so many jobs to the East. Mm-hmm. Any questions on this so far, huh? Because I want to eventually shift, we've got a half hour or so left, and look a little bit more at the last one. Yeah?
Well, what about the shadow sides of this? The shadow elements of the our country having better, let's say, environmental laws than the other countries, and then with the dumping of chemicals in Mexico and stuff, so it can be more competitive into our markets, etc., and our companies allowing that. I mean, being there and investors and
it's a major problem. I mean, absolutely. I mean, you are correct. And our government has been severely criticized for not having those those provisions, especially on the environment, enforced. It's not enforced.
So I mean, I've heard some some politicians or economists, you know, meeting and talking on C-SPAN, and they were basically saying this is a race to the bottom. Sure, we've got the lowest. You're getting your prices at the lowest goods. I mean, at the lowest cost. Mm-hmm. But at what cost?
Yeah.
Ultimately, to our societies and peoples and to our environment.
Yep.
So you're not here to advocate for any. I mean, you're just
trying what I'm trying to do here today is to point out what has gone on. I mean, you find the trade has expanded. And I've also tried my best to point out that there are major problems, and you are pointing out one of them. You. Any other questions for him? Yeah.
The Second Age, was it actually a new age, or was it one where other countries just took over the colonial power?
Oh, you mean here from 1945 to the present?
Yeah, because we still call it BP, British Petroleum.
Oh, yeah, BP. But, well, now, what is your question?
And then Vietnam ended up being our taking over the French colonies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering if it was just new players taking over the former colonies. And then, to some degree.
Well, to some degree, but I mean, you know, the British Empire continued on and off various places into the 50s and 60s. The French Empire continued on and off into the 60s and 70s in certain areas. The areas became independent. They had a terribly hard time developing their own economies because they'd never been essentially permitted to participate in the development of their own country. And that's one of the biggest problems of colonialism, was that indeed decisions were made not in the best self-interest of the colony, but the best self-interest of London, Paris, Lisbon, any number of things. And that's been a wrenching problem to how indeed for those former colonies to indeed develop, whether it's the infrastructure or their know-how and all this. Because, you know, knowledge is something that is not developed overnight. The knowledge of how to do things is something that is accumulative.
It's almost like a new mercantilism, because now the companies have taken back over from the nations,
yep.
And they've got monopolies, and they're running their own monopolies, and they're, I mean, De Beers and everybody else, they're all being very careful about how they control and monitor all of that. Sometimes violently.
Anything else? Good point. Anything else?
Just to let you know,
yeah.
This ends at 6:30, not 6:45.
So seven.
Oh, yeah, well, 12 minutes left. Thank you. Thank you. I mean, I've done a lot of afternoon sessions, and I think the hour is a little different than it is. I should know that. But this is the first evening session I've done, so when I looked at it, I thought, oh, well, it's 7:45. So, thank you. Thank you. Because I would have run over. I'm pretty good at ending on time, but I wouldn't have. Thank you. Any other questions or comments here? I thought I ought to do something on that last thing before we're done here. Let me define a little bit about the term imperialism and colonialism. Well, and it isn't all that important, but one of the ways to look at imperialism is simply a nation or a political entity expanding its control over another area. One of the ways to think of imperialism is the expansion of a nation's control over another area. And technically, there are several ways to do it. I mean, there is what you could call the physical occupation of another country. But you can also do it simply by gaining complete control, for instance, over its trade. There's a term, and I shouldn't even have brought this up, but it's called the imperialism of free trade. And no country was better at it than Great Britain. See, the thing is that if Britain or any European nation had had its choice, they wouldn't have occupied another area because it's so costly. In terms of humans, resources, armies, government, it's expensive. So the ideal thing would have been for you to take over control of it through trade, and then you got the best of all worlds, because your country, through its people, through its trade, is making an enormous amount of revenue, of money. England was phenomenal what it did in places of Spanish America, Central America, and South America. I mean, they, especially the Roman railroads. British were the first developers of railroads in the world. So you can go to a place like, I think Argentina particularly, but others too. England sent the engineers to design the railroads, to build them. It frequently ended up sending the workers, including the Irish, to do the railroad beds. They sent the iron, they sent the rolling stock for the railroads. Then they sent the goods to be traded, to be carried on those railroads. It was absolutely amazing what went on. And that's a really efficient means of gaining control over another country, where you let the government continue to operate in Argentina, but meanwhile, you've gained control of its trade. But imperialism, I look at, one of the ways to look at it is gaining control one way or another over another area. Colonialism is the means by which essentially a government controls that area, what they do on ground level. Because frankly, there wasn't a lot of this free trade imperialism that I talked about. Europeans ended up going into other countries and taking over control, setting up their own governments, gaining control over, frankly, all parts of life, including the culture. So it's sometimes you can refer to also as cultural colonialism or cultural imperialism, imposing your way of life on others. The French were particularly good at that. The French said, we have the greatest civilization in the world, and by goodness, you're going to be a little Frenchies. And that's essentially what happens. British weren't quite that way. They did not impose the British culture as much on their
own. And then the French revolutions for independence were bloodier.
Yeah, but that's even earlier. That's, we won't, yeah, it was. To give you some idea, and Candace, you raised this question about the amount of the world that was under European control. And I'm going to apply this just to Africa. For the first, until about 1870 or 1880, Europe had very little control over Africa. All they had were footholds around the edge. They hadn't gone into the interior really much at all. From 1880 to 1912, they gobbled up Africa. By 1912, they had control over all of Africa except for Ethiopia and Liberia. Ethiopia and Liberia were the only two areas of Africa not controlled by Europe. The only two, by 1912. The only two areas. It's similar things went on elsewhere in the world, but not to the extreme that it is in Africa. This was made possible, this European control over Africa and other parts of the world was made possible, especially by technological developments in Europe. I mean, just like globalization today is facilitated by technology, so it was in the 19th century. Better rifles. Far more efficient rifles, instead of the old matchlock things where the powder was in the open or something, you took it into a place in tropical Africa, it became, you know, humidity destroyed it right away. I mean, it simply wouldn't work. It had to be generally the more sophisticated rifles that developed in the course of the 19th century made it possible for Europeans to actually be efficient in Africa. Another thing that was so important was that it was the development of steam in Europe. Because steam then particularly made it possible for Europeans to have steamboats. And the steamboats went up the river. I mean, the English control that they gained over Egypt in the 1800s was particularly facilitated by the steamboats that went up the Nile River. And you can look at that everywhere. And it also facilitated because when the Europeans took over control of an area, they built railroads in so many of those colonies because that not only made it possible for them to help increase trade, but it made possible for them to move troops in any number of them. But probably the most important thing for Europeans was the development of new medicines. And the most important was quinine. Because until about the 1870s, 60s or 70s, Europeans going into the interior died. I mean, they died. They died in huge numbers. I mean, it was not unusual for an expedition into the interior for a year or two to come back. He'd come back with 10 or 15% of the people. The others had simply died. Because they had none of the built-in inoculations and everything that the natives of the areas had. So the cost on the part of the Europeans, human and with regards to goods, finally by roughly 1880, the cost of human and other things had dropped so much that the Europeans could essentially go into Africa and take over. Until that time, they didn't do it. They couldn't do it. Another thing the European nations did in Africa specifically was, and I suppose it's like the GATT or the General Agreement on Tariff and Trade, they in 1885-1886 made a decision on the basic rules for dividing up Africa. There are three or four or five, I can't remember them all now, but effective occupation was one of the things, earliest occupation of an area, and so it went on. So they set up the ground rules. The tariff rule, whatever you want to call it, for going in. Motives for this? Almost totally economic. You sometimes find things with regards to religion, but religion was way in the background. I mean, it was not the driving force. If it had been just religious or missionary efforts, it wouldn't have gotten any place. The primary thing was economic. That industrialization in Europe of the 19th century dictated, or Europeans thought it forced them to find new sources of raw material. And they found them in Africa, one of the areas they found them. They had to have new foodstuffs for this exploding European population. And of course, it started earlier, but increasing amounts of drinking, like tea, coffee, particularly cocoa, in the course of the 19th century. Another thing that the Europeans wanted was markets for their own goods. They're producing goods, I mean, they got them up to their ears. I mean, they could produce more than enough industrial goods, and they had to look for other markets. Let me just do a couple more things.
Well,
I
wanted you to have 2 more minutes. So
wait, I have 2 minutes. Okay, yes. I know, I'm about done. I will simply end by saying that probably the greatest similarity between this age of colonialism and globalization comes in the area of the exploitation of labor. That's the greatest similarity. The Europeans, when they took over an area, particularly an area, let's say, of the worst place was the Congo. In fact, wherever they went, the basis for economic life then and now is labor. Never forget that. I mean, you even have to have people running machines. Yeah. Most of the time now. Not always. Okay. Nothing's more important than labor. And they figured out one way or another to get labor. They almost always used some form of coercion. Every single nation, Britain, Holland, France, Germany, Belgium, they all used coercion. Some of you resorted to a continuation of slavery. Others, and the more favorite one, was to force all the people in an area to pay tax in money, in currency, which force them to get a job, jobs almost always primarily available through European companies in that country, so they had to get a job in order to pay their taxes. And it worked very, very well. Now, I guess time is up.
Yeah.
But we can take questions for a minute or two, but go ahead.
So,